Hello and welcome to There Will Be Pod, a 32 Fans movie podcast where we talk about movies past, present, and occasionally future. My name is Av Sinensky.
And I'm Sammy Chester.
And I'm John Gilpatrick. And today we're going to be talking about the movies of September 2021, including the musical Come From Away and Paul Schrader's The Card Counter. And what else, guys? Much else?
I think I like the way you introduced Card Counter, Paul Schrader's, because when we get to that, I think most of us would say the director was a larger part of the appeal based on his past movie, but you know, I'm sure we'll dig into that soon. But there's certain movies, John and I were talking about this just before you jumped on, we're talking about like how we choose what we'll see. And John, something you didn't say, but I think maybe you were about to say, is that simply a star director, or maybe a star actor, but these days more likely a star director, that will pull you in, or maybe even a star studio, like an A24 will just pull you in no matter what.
Yeah, definitely the director thing. I think the studio thing is there's probably something there. A24 like weirdly releases a lot of movies that like you never hear a peep from, and then they'll have like five or six of like huge profile kind of independent driven movies. But the director thing has become kind of my go-to in terms of like, is there something besides like a friend's recommendation who I, you know, trust that like is going to definitely get me to see something that I'm potentially on the fence about. Like if they've directed something that I found even interesting, whether I liked or not in the past, then I'm probably going to check that out. And that ultimately kind of was the case with The Card Counter, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But yeah, I don't know. For me, like this was a quiet month. Last month was a quiet month as well. It's just not a ton of stuff that I wanted to see. And I kind of got lucky in terms of the few movies that I did watch, I ended up liking. So I don't know that like I can dodge that minefield forever, but I've had two pretty lucky months in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah. I my impression 2021 as a whole, people, you know, loyal listeners may have noticed who've been down the line with Av and myself and with John as well now, is that we try to have a big feature of the month. And I think one of the reasons we haven't done that simply in 2021 is it's been a scattershot pretty much every month. I mean, I can't think of a clear cut, like must be feature that I've been drawn to so far this year. You know, as I said, you know, last month I caught a movie I really liked in Together, but still there hasn't been something that has screamed feature of the month, whether it's a tentpole or whether it's like a critically loved and we also were drawn to it, you know, smaller feature. So I think that's as much the programming as anything else in terms of why we've taken a more scattershot, which, you know, I think we'll talk about now in terms of what we liked and disliked from September.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, you know, it's one of those situations where, like, I feel like this year we keep saying, well, you know, that next month, you know, the good movies are going to come. Next month, the good movies are going to come.
Be patient.
And now it's October, and it's really not been a very strong movie year. I mean, it's... you know, obviously, I'm sure the pandemic plays a role. You know, I guess maybe there were movies in development or that just like never got going because of delays. But, you know, as things stand now, I mean, last year, I think is way ahead of this year. And last year was not a particularly good year because of all the things that were canceled and delayed. But yeah, I mean, we're three quarters of the way into the year. And it's not a very impressive year thus far.
Yeah, it's put up or shut up time the last
year. Yeah, seriously. Two strikes. Yeah. The last 2 months were strikes. And I think October is going to be, you know, is the batter staying at the plate or are they heading back to the dugout?
Yeah, and, you know, we'll probably, you know, get to it at the episode's close. There are a number of things on the agenda for October that certainly seem very promising.
Yeah.
That will have a lot of fanfare. I guess the verdict remains to be seen when we come back next month. But, you know, 9 months down, three to go. Let's hope it's a great fourth quarter.
So what, John, maybe you can start us off while we're still in the dog days of end of summer in the third quarter. I was trying to think what you were mentioning it before, Av and John. The NFL primetime show or whatever it's called. I know in overseas it's called something different than in the US, but where you're watching like multi-screens.
The Red Zone.
The Red Zone channel, yeah. So he has this line he says every week where as the 1 p.m. games enter the fourth quarter, he says, or as they enter like the last 5 minutes of like the first slate of games, he has this line he always says where he says, we're entering the whatever.
The witching hour. The witching hour. Wins turn into losses and losses turn to wins.
Exactly.
It makes me cringe every single week. I'm an absolute Red Zone apologist. I watch upwards of 6 hours of Red Zone every single week. And that's the one thing I will not apologize for, or it will not be an apologist for, because it's like such a horribly written line of dialogue that they feel the need to use it over and over every week.
Yeah.
No one said, who calls that the witching hour? Whatever.
I don't know. Yeah, I find it very odd too.
We're gonna go with There Will Be Pod, that the next 3 months are the witching quarter.
The witching quarter.
The witching quarter of 2021.
Fair enough.
Remind us next month. We have to start off the episode by saying hello and welcome to the witching quarter has arrived.
Is that the new name of the podcast for October through December? We could say where hits turn to misses and misses turn to hits.
Exactly. Well, it's gonna be true in this case. But John, any hits or misses from September that you had a chance to catch up with?
Yeah, so like I said, I didn't see a ton this month in terms of new releases. At least I did catch up on a couple titles from earlier this year that I missed, which I was, you know, again, like relatively high on. I think I finally saw A Quiet Place Part 2, which I enjoyed, not as much as the first. I think that was kind of the general consensus when we spoke on that earlier this year, but I liked it.
Yeah.
I finally saw F9, which I thought was a little bit better than kind of its general consensus, even though I would say it's, you know, bottom half of the franchise. I don't think it was the worst installment of the franchise. And I saw Stillwater, the Matt Damon movie, which was, I think, not so loosely based on the Amanda Knox story.
Yeah.
Again, that was kind of a forgettable movie, but I don't think it was bad per se. Like, I felt like there were elements of it that were interesting and it didn't totally come together in a super satisfying way, but it wasn't like a waste of time either. So some stuff I caught up with that I felt like had redeeming qualities, even if none of them were, you know, unqualified successes. The one movie that I liked, I would say the most of this kind of bunch of things that I saw this month that are perhaps unique to among the three of us was called Worth. And this
Netflix.
Is a movie that was
Netflix.
Yeah, right? A Netflix movie. It premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2020. And Netflix bought it for, I think, a really large net worth. For some reason, it was delayed until this September. And not surprising that it was a September movie. It's about the sort of the true story behind the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund. Stars Michael Keaton and Stanley Tucci and Amy Ryan, I would say, is kind of the three primary characters. Michael Keaton and Amy Ryan are lawyers who are hired by the federal government to oversee the dispensation of funds to families who lost somebody on 9/11. The idea being that the federal government feared like a giant class action lawsuit that would kind of cripple the economy and particularly the airline industry.
So this is a true story.
This is based on the real people and the real fund.
So the question here always that Av and I have asked in the past about these, you know, based on real life events, particularly contemporary events, is does this pass the, would it be more interesting as a New York Times Magazine piece or Wikipedia read, or is it better as a movie watch?
I liked it as a movie. It's not like a particularly cinematic. I mean, I'm telling you about things like class action lawsuits and victim compensation funds. You know, like it doesn't sound cinematic. And I don't feel like it was kind of directed with much flair, with all due respect to the filmmakers. But I would say that like there's conversations that take place between like really good actors that I feel like might not, you know, translate in an article or whatever. It's partially based on obviously real events, but the actual biography of the main lawyer who's played by Michael Keaton. He has this sort of very mathematical, direct way of calculating like what these families should get and trying to be fair. And Stanley Tucci is sort of he's a widower in the film who lost his wife on 9/11. But he thinks that Keaton and the others are going about this all wrong and they need to handle sort of each case individually.
The report? The report that came out, I guess, 2 years ago at this point, the Adam Driver kind of, again,
The torture movie with Annette Bening played Diane Feinstein.
Yeah. So I would also say the report was kind of a rigorous based on a 9/11 related true story. There's a court element to it. I mean, it's not as much of a trial, but to what extent does this movie sort of a twin piece with The Report, or not necessarily.
Actually, I think it's a good comparison. I didn't think of The Report when I was watching this, I think because I found The Report fairly forgettable.
It's actually pronounced The Report.
The Report. that's true. I thought this one just like has a little bit more soul to it. That one was, I think, kind of deliberately supposed to be by the book, and its characters were sort of ciphers. And
oh, so
this
I really like that.
Yeah. Did you? Okay. Yeah, I thought it was good. It didn't really like do much for me, but I thought it was fine.
I was a big fan of it as well.
Okay. Yeah. This one is like a little bit more humane, and you know, some people I think might say, yeah, feels a little saccharine, perhaps. You know, you're trying to feel good about everybody and everything.
A little more audience friendly.
Yeah, but for me, like,
Report was not trying to be audience friendly.
No, it really wasn't. It was kind of going out of its way to not be that. I think in a lot of instances, but this one, like, you want to feel good about everybody. There's shades of gray involved, and you know, you're supposed to, I think, in the end, feel like everybody's trying to do the right thing, and then and things, you know, wrap up in a neat sort of way. But so, but I thought it was a pretty good movie.
I did not have a chance to see it. It is on my catch-up list. It's on Netflix. It's accessible. And, you know, I think it's one of those, I'm curious what mine and Av, I don't know if you've seen it or what you will, but like, I'm curious if it'll pass the Wikipedia test for me. It sounds, John, you made a pretty good case that it will. My connection to the movie, though, briefly is, one thing that I think even people that are really into movies know very little about, and I don't plan too much about this either, is the world of like mid-level movie producers, meaning all those names that pop up before, mainly, I guess, before the movie starts, in terms of executive producer, all the different kinds of producers that movies have. And the reason I mention that is I met this random guy from New York who, together with a few business partners in Boston, has a movie production studio, and they produced a number of movies, including Worth. Oh. And so I met this guy at this like high-tech investment event in Tel Aviv, like 2 or 3 years ago, right before Corona. And we got on, and we've emailed since, and like we shared some random thing. I think this guy has like a finger in a lot of businesses, and we're connected on LinkedIn. You know, this is like a nerdy LinkedIn topic. And so this guy shared on LinkedIn a month ago, at the beginning of the month, being like, hey, professional network, I really want you to see this new movie that I produced called Worth. And that's how I heard about it. And it was just kind of like such a random, like this guy who will never be a known quantity. You know, he's not like a heavyweight Harvey Weinstein sort of producer, you know?
I would hope not.
in every sense, but like, I'm sure he's a good guy, you know? But my point is, you know, I think there's a world, and I don't know, maybe you guys have insights into this from any angle, that the people who are behind the creation of movies sometimes are not like a full-on Hollywood type figures. I mean, this guy lives in New York, he has sort of an investment business in Boston, and he's like a lawyer, you know, whatever. So that's my connection to Worth so far, in that my nerdy professional investment contact helped produce the movie. But yeah, I hope to catch up, like you caught up with movies, and then tell you what I think, John, next month.
Sure.
Anything so it sounds like nothing you really disliked. So anything else you want to hit us with?
I mean, those were, in terms of like, you know, new and new-ish releases, that's sort of where this month, you know, where I landed this month. Obviously, there's a couple of movies that we all saw, I think, that we're going to talk about, but I'm happy to see the floor to yourself or to Av to talk about some of the, I guess, more unique titles that you caught up with.
Av, how about you?
Yeah, I saw a few things. I saw Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, the new Marvel movie that came out at the beginning of this month. I actually saw it twice in theaters, once with some friends, and then went back with my wife and kids.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It's really, you know, great always having an excuse to go to the movie theater, seeing a fun new movie with a crowd. My kids had a blast. It's, you know, their second Marvel movie that they had seen in theater after seeing Black Widow. As for the movie itself, I would say I liked it. I didn't love it. It was kind of middle of the road, maybe a little bit below for me in terms of the MCU rankings. I thought that some of the performances were really great. The lead is really good. The character that plays his father is really great. I think he's actually like a legendary actor.
Yeah, probably the most prominent, particularly within Asia, like Asian actor.
Yeah, Yeah.
So Tony Leung, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I thought a lot of like the character work and world building was really great, especially in the first half. I thought Awkwafina was really funny. I really love her. Pretty much whenever I get the opportunity to see her in something. The third act, I think, had really significant issues, some of which are typical for a Marvel movie, some of which I think were pretty unique to this one. Overall, I thought it was, solid, perfectly good, fun, enjoyable time at the movies for a Marvel movie, but not among the best of what Marvel has to offer. But I am very excited to see this character continue on in the MCU. I think they really established a good entry point for him, and it should be very exciting to see where things go next.
What character would you say he's, so to speak, replacing in like the MCU? Like, he's the one-to-one to who? To Captain America? To
I would say probably the character that he reminded me the most of in certain ways was T'Challa. Obviously portrayed by the late, great Chadwick Boseman, in terms of having this just like wisdom and just like stillness and centeredness to him, where, the face does a lot of acting. It's not always, a very loud, pronounced role. Mm-hmm. But there's still a lot going on beneath the surface. Maybe he could kind of fill that role to an extent.
Yeah. So other kind of quick question, just did you have, or to what extent did you have any relationship? Awkwafina, you already said, and we saw the movie she was in last year and discussed it then, but the two male leads in this movie, in Shang-Chi. So Tony Leung, as we discussed, and then I don't know how to pronounce his name exactly, Sima Liu.
I hadn't been exposed to much of the work, at least not that I know of. I mean, it's possible I've seen something that either one of them has been in, but they weren't known commodities to me coming into Shang-Chi.
So my wife is really into, I don't know if this rings a bell for you whatsoever, my wife is really into Kim's Convenience, which is this TV sitcom show. It's just like a, comedy about a Korean family with a little grocery store, very much like a TV sitcom comedy. And the son in the show is Simu Liu, who's the star. So I think, this movie's obviously his major breakup, but he's been on that show. I think the show's been going for like 5 years. So it's like a 5-year, it has like a Brooklyn Nine-Nine vibe, just with less prominent actors. But what's funny is that in that show, his sister, I would say, is sort of an Awkwafina fangirl, meaning like his sister's role is sort of, she acts in that TV show in the way that Awkwafina always acts in her movies. So I don't know whether that's like a typecast, like friendly Asian girl role in cinema and TV. I don't know. But when I saw the trailers, I couldn't catch up to Shang-Chi. I tried. When I saw the trailers for Shang-Chi, I was like, oh, it's sort of like they've taken the relationship in Kim's Convenience, which my wife swears by. She loves the show. So I don't know if any other fans out there. It's like they've taken that relationship from this TV show and they've swapped out the actress for the sister. And they've kept the actor for the son, and then just made a movie with Marvel around it. But that was my kind of relationship for a movie I haven't yet seen. And then Tony Leung obviously has a much longer history. But he's like a big name.
He's in all the Wong Kar-wai films, and he was the star of the, if you saw it, Infernal Affairs, which is sort of the series of movies that The Departed is based on. So he's like got a extensive filmography. I have a fun fact about Awkwafina. Which is that technically, although we never crossed paths, she and I used to be coworkers. And so my first job out of college, I worked for Men's Health magazine, and she was a publicist for the same publishing company. So like I said, I never met her or worked with her on anything, but for a short while we were colleagues, and I was, I always bring that up whenever she, is in something or winning some award, which was frequently last year, if you remember.
I think when she's on podcasts, she often brings that up as well.
Yeah, she's talked about it a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, the movie critic John G, the John G Award.
Oh, you mean she talks about me? Oh, I thought you meant she talked about before she was famous. I think I have heard her talk a little bit about that, and maybe it wasn't exactly... highlight. I can win a Golden Globe one day. Come on.
Yeah. No. If she rose from the same modest footsteps of John Kilpatrick, then I expect.
Yeah. Come on.
You're still rising. You're still rising as well. Av, did you, one to one, if someone was only going to see one MCU movie so far this year, Would you say this, or you would say the lady one? Sorry, I'm blanking on the name.
Oh, yeah, I like Black Widow a lot more.
But how much of that is your daughter loves Black Widow? You have a relationship with Black Widow over 5-6 movies.
I'm sure some of it is that. If you ask me to separate that, I'm not sure that I can do that. I mean, obviously the fact that I have a, you know, many year relationship with that character who finally got a solo movie is part of what I enjoyed about the movie, whereas this was a new character. And frankly, I would say some of the things that bother me about this movie is that they didn't, in my opinion, do a ton to establish the character like so much at the beginning of the movie. Like they kind of just like jump in, so like all of a sudden now he's a superhero without us really grounding him in like the non-superhero version of this person. So
yeah, I haven't seen it yet, so like obviously I can't comment so much, but at some point I feel that having every, and Doctor Strange is just sort of the origins that I think of the most, you know, having every kind of MCU intro movie have to sort of walk you through the sort of, you know, he was a typical surgeon and then he had an accident and then he was depressed and then he had superpowers. You know, like it's kind of nice sometimes just to jump to the, he has superpowers.
Right. But like, you know, there's something lacking for me in characterization when I don't really have an understanding for like who this person is outside of being a superhero. Like, I mean, all the best, you know, characters in the MCU, the Captain America, Steve Rogers, Tony Stark, like we really understood who the person is behind the mask before we really get to know the superhero. And I think, you know, and obviously, you know, they're clearly trying to go away from the very formulaic origin stories. Like the last few have all tried a different model, like what, even going back to Captain Marvel. And, you know, there's obviously different ways to do that, but I think you still do need to establish that character work for there to be, you know, a real connection to the character.
So I would say give it like maybe 2 or 3 episodes. It doesn't matter the order of Kim Convenience Store, because I've only seen the trailers, but I haven't seen Shang-Chi, but the just watching the trailers, it seems the actor has exactly the same persona. And so Kim Convenience Store can serve as like the backdrop, because in Kim Convenience Store, he's this like average guy who works at a rental car, but he's really muscular and fit and like he can like do athletic achievements, but he's a very run-of-the-mill like Asian guy living in San Diego. So I think Kim Convenience Store might be the missing piece to give you sort of the humanization of this new MCU hero. That's my tip for a movie. Hopefully I'll catch up soon. Ab, can I give you 1 or 2 as well?
Yeah.
Okay, so one rides right off your MCU Disney line, which is Ryan Reynolds produced, I want to say he kind of co-envisioned, and he certainly was the lead in a movie called Free Guy that came out, I think, at the end of August, and I had a chance to catch up in September, and it completely worked for me. It's Ryan Reynolds humor to the T, much more even than Deadpool. So if some of that kind of Deadpool style humor isn't your style whatsoever, then I don't know if you'll necessarily like Free Guy. I think Free Guy is the best version so far of... I haven't seen the original Tron, but I saw the new Tron when it came out a few years ago. I saw that really bad Spielberg movie that came out a few years ago. You know, all these movies that are sort of like imagining the new video game culture, and then they're imagining what if a character in the video game, a little bit like the Lego movie. I've seen the Lego movie compared to Free Guy, and I like Lego movie better. But Free Guy is not very original. It's like all those other movies, which is the idea of Free Guy is that this NPC, this fake background character in a real life simulation video game world is kind of comes to existence, so to speak. Like you could say the Matrix, there's a lot of like Matrix puns as well. And he sort of comes into his own because his AI evolves in a way that it wasn't really supposed to. And because this background character played by Ryan Reynolds is now sort of alive, so to speak, he sees the Matrix for what it is. And therefore starts interacting. It's just, the movie has wonderful relationships. It has really emotional moments that are hard to describe how it worked. And it's funny. There's a laugh out loud scene, which has been, I think, spoiled all over YouTube at this point, but there's a laugh out loud scene with the MCU. They sort of rip and they make fun of the MCU. Taiki Waititi, whose name I'm probably butchering in every direction, he plays the bad guy and he's amazing in them. He's really fun.
That's actually the first name you've pronounced correctly on this podcast.
Okay. Well,
amazingly.
Well, he just rips into his like bad guy, megalomaniacal, Silicon Valley, like, you know, cheesy, like there's a scene where he waltzes in and looking like a complete puff and they're like, oh, you just came from Burning Man. And it's just like, he like digs into his role with so much glee and he's having so much, he has this great aside that Ryan Reynolds shared on YouTube when Disney, who made the movie, immediately greenlit it for a sequel. And there's a scene in the movie where Taika Waititi is basically saying, like, who cares about the quality and the content of the video games we make? It's all about IP. It's all about branding. We're just going to rip off a bunch of shitty sequels to this video game and people will pay for it because that's all they do these days. And so Ryan Reynolds, who I feel like wrote that scene, he then shared that clip with the announcement that Disney was greenlighting a sequel. He's like, oh, isn't this ironic? I would say really fun movie. You know, it's nothing groundbreaking, but one of the more fun times I've had in 2021. So strong recommend is Free Guy. Had either of you guys had a chance to see it? Were you completely writing it off?
I started it, although I was watching it on like a bootleg, very poor version.
I waited until a great version came out.
So I got like 20 minutes in and I lost interest, but I think that some of that might have been like the sound quality and just the picture quality. I just kind of like lost traction. So I'm definitely open to giving it a real shot because it didn't take for me the first time.
Yeah. My heart was in my throat, like during some of the emotional scenes at the end, and you wouldn't think they could have achieved that. But basically Ryan Reynolds has this other NPC bank security guard who's played by an African-American actor whose name I forget. And the two of them have like a real wonderful relationship, and like they both sacrifice each other at some points. And that was my favorite scene. It's one of my favorite scenes of 2021, actually, sacrifice scene. So I had a great fun time with Free Guy. It's up there. I would urge people to see it. Like, it's just a movie that, again, unless you, I don't love Deadpool, and I like this a lot more than Deadpool.
I hate Deadpool.
So if you really,
so that's why I was like afraid to check this out.
If you really dislike Deadpool, then I would see maybe this won't work for you. But I think even so, it will work for you.
I'll give it a try.
Yeah, it's like a very innocent, sweet, like, you know, just, you know, Ryan Reynolds humor left and right in every direction. So that's a recommend. Two others I would say are sort of like good but not great. Quickly, one of them is Slalom is like the Me Too athlete movie, and what I'll direct listeners to simply is that it's nowhere near The Assistant or Never Rarely from last year. It doesn't have the artistry of that. It basically lacks enough story, but it's a very well-made movie by a first-time director. John referenced what you had said, but what I'll just leave listeners with: Av and I did an episode at the beginning of 2020 about the Winter Olympics as part of our sports marathon with Kiev. And we spoke about a movie from 1969 with Robert Redford and Gene Hackman called Downhill Racer, which is considered critically to be like the best movie ever made about, you know, alpine skiing. And I think this is now the best movie made, but it's cool. Not that many people I think have seen Downhill Racer. Obviously, if you're a real fan of the Worldly Pod, you have. But it is kind of cool.
I love Downhill Racer.
Oh yeah. Oh, awesome. So John, yeah. I mean, John was a fan before becoming a host. So, you know, he checks off every
box. Yeah. Both boxes.
There are some people who love Downhill Racer. I like this better than Downhill Racer, but the two really work well together because that's like an entitled ego male view of alpine skiing and the challenges maybe in the 60s. And this is very much, you know, contemporary. The story of Salem is like obvious coming in. It's a coach who basically sexually abuses and rapes his champion female skier. It's ripped directly from what we know of the gymnastics and I guess the women's soccer that we've been reading about the last few weeks. So it's very much that story, but it's a nice compliment to Downhill Racer. I think John, you might, you know, particularly appreciate them. Did you ever see Downhill Racer at the time?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It was like good. I didn't love it as much as John, it seems. Was a fan.
I really like that movie. And it's been a long time since I saw it. I should probably revisit it because I think I have the DVD around here. But
it'd be fun if you revisit that and then you have a chance to see Slalom in the same week and then let us know what you think. Wild Indian, another first-time director. Wild Indian was, again, good but not great. It's a story about two Native Americans, and they tell you this from the first scene. They committed a crime. One of them committed a crime when they were a kid. And then the other one sort of let him off, like just ignored it. And then most of the movie is as they're adults and they're sort of dealing with the guilt of that. Again, it's good, but what the movie doesn't do enough, first off, it spends way too much time showing them as kids. And the best parts of the movie is when they're adults. Both adult actors are really good. The kid actors are so boring. So way too much time in a fairly short movie as kids. It's a 90-minute movie and 30 minutes are as kids. So if it would have been an hour movie, I think it would have been far enhanced. I think if they would have spliced in the scenes of what they, their original sin, it would have been better. But, you know, it's a pretty conventional, you sort of see where it's going. I think the movie needed even more like Native American cultural specificity, if that sort of makes sense to you. Meaning the actual story you've seen 100 times, which is people committed a crime as children, and the guilt of that is chasing them into their adulthood, and each of them is dealing with that guilt in different ways. That's the story. That's the movie. What gives the movie a distinctiveness is that the director is a Native American, and it makes sort of a move toward really embracing Native American themes within the idea of these two young guys who grew out of the reservation, but they have this original sin. But it doesn't, I think, double down enough on the distinctiveness of maybe the Native American themes. There's one really great scene where the worst of the two guys as an adult is basically yelling at someone and saying, oh, am I supposed to, he's like, he has a line, and I'm trying to quote it as best I can because it's really powerful, where he says something, he's like, the best Native Americans died fighting the white man 100 years ago. Our generation are just the fuck ups who gave in and surrendered then. And that's why I'm such a screw up. And that's why all of us are such screw ups. And, you know, when you consider that the actors in this movie are all Native Americans, the director is a Native American, there's, I think, a power to that line even more so. But the movie doesn't have enough of that. So again, I'd recommend it if that style, that's kind of story. I don't know if I gave it enough of a spin. I think it got some like awards out of Sundance or something. It's kind of movie I would think would do well at Sundance, you know, Native Americans. Isn't Sundance in like the West? So I don't know if I convinced either one of you guys. It's accessible. It's out there.
Yeah, I'm open to it.
Okay. Yeah, very quickly, Nicolas Cage, Japanese director Sion Sono, they were supposed to release a movie in January. It got delayed until September, called Prisoner of the Ghost Land. I think my worst movie of the year. Absolutely disaster.
Oh no.
Boring. Not funny. Like, Nicolas Cage is like his worst phoning it in. Just complete miss. Like, spare yourself. I think it's in English. I couldn't even tell. The movie is really, really a miss. And that's a shame, because it should have been like the most gonzo Nicolas Cage movie. Basically, he's like a hitman in some sort of, what's the Tom Hardy movie where he's, the sequel Tom Hardy movie where he's driving around in the desert? It's the Mel Gibson sequel from the 80s.
Oh, Mad Max.
Yeah, exactly. So this is like a Mad Maxian world, but Nicolas Cage is playing the Mel Gibson Nick Cage character, and Nick Cage is like a bomb strapped to his testicles. That was like the pitch of the movie. Like, Nicolas Cage is in a movie where he has a bomb strapped to his testicles, and he has to like save the day before the bomb goes off. The movie does absolutely nothing with that setup. It's so boring. Please do not see Prisoners of the Ghostland. I'll leave it with one word. I think I'm the biggest fan of all three of us of the Daniel Craig Bond series. I've liked every one to date. I think the Bond movie that came out in Israel and outside of the US in September, and it's coming out in the US when, you guys, this week or next week?
This Friday is our recording.
I think this is one of the worst Bond movies ever made. I was so disappointed. And again, like, I'm a Daniel Craig truther. I've loved his Bond movies. I've liked all of them. None of them to me is bad. This one was, I've never been so emotionally disconnected from a movie. I was like, am I supposed to care now? Because the music is trying to make me care, and I don't care whatsoever. So we can discuss it next month when you guys have a chance, or if you take my advice and don't catch up with it. But as you guys know, this is the first movie I saw in theaters in quite some time. Definitely since Corona.
Yeah.
And that
maybe that's why you hate it.
No, I thought that would help.
You like watching movies on the bus.
Yeah, but I'm susceptible to sort of a big Bond-style movie. This is basically, it's not a Bond movie. I'll leave the rest for you guys to catch up if you want to see it. I would say it's like a Fast and Furious.
I'll probably see it. Why not?
I'm going to say I love the Bond series, even though the two of the four, I think, Daniel Craig movies are pretty doo-doo. But,
I think they're all great, but this is, I don't know, if you've disliked some of them, then, you know, good luck, John, good luck. That's all.
Okay, fair enough.
to be continued. But John, you did ensure that I saw a movie that I wasn't expecting to see this month, and that was Come From Away. So can you
tell us
what is Come From Away, and why was it the best musical movie adaptation to see this month?
Well, probably for lack of options, but I think it's still worthy. This is a Broadway musical. I never saw the Broadway musical, but my wife did, and she really loved it. And she was always talking about, like, oh, we need to go to the city and see Come From Away. And for some reason in my head, I thought it was called Come From What May. And so I always called it that, and she would correct me. But It's neither here nor there, but we were planning on actually going into the city to see it. And then this thing called coronavirus happened. So that was not an option, but I was excited to find out that they were doing the sort of the Hamilton treatment where they're going to film it on stage with the original cast, I think, and release it as a sort of film. And in this case, it was released to Apple Plus, right? Yeah. Apple TV Plus.
They came together like 3 months ago to perform on Broadway only for the point of filming. That's correct?
Yeah.
So it was like
It
was like a one night only. I think I've read they had like 9/11 first responders in the theater, yeah. Free tickets. Yeah. Because they seemed in watching, I never heard of it as a play, but in watching the film that we all saw, they seemed particularly kind of committed. It wasn't, you know, because when I went into it, I thought, oh, did they just film this on a random night and, you know, maybe put together the filming of multiple nights into like the best version? But it makes sense. Like this was like a special, they went into knowing this is like the last time we're maybe all going to be on stage performing this, because you can feel it in the performances.
Yeah, I mean, almost certainly, because there are some of the cast members who are in the movie that are no longer performing the actual musical, assuming that they've resumed performing the musical, but who won't be when they do resume it. But anyway, it is about September 11th, and sort of this like wild true story of I can't remember they called it. It's like Operation Something, like in real life. And I can't remember what it was actually called. But basically, like when the planes were grounded in the United States, like all these
Operation flights, Yellow Ribbon.
Yellow Ribbon, yes, okay. So they couldn't fly to, over the United States. All these planes had to land, and ones that were coming over the Atlantic, there was this big abandoned airport on like the coast of Newfoundland, where when planes, couldn't carry as much fuel, they would always stop back in the, 40s, 50s, 60s, stop there to refuel before finishing their journey to the States or elsewhere in Canada. But once the planes got bigger, they could accommodate more fuel.
Empty airport. And nobody
needed to stop at Newfoundland. So they had this big empty airport. So this is a place that theoretically they could land a bunch of planes that needed to emergency land because of what was happening that day. Of course, there's a small town on the island, and they can't necessarily accommodate, 38 planes or something like that full of passengers for an indeterminate period of time. But the story of the musical is sort of the town coming together and trying to do everything they can to take care of these people and give them their needs, their food, their, clothing and shelter and everything else, while also kind of like grappling with the gravity of what took place that day. And you sort of learn about individual people. The pilot, I think, is probably one of the more prominent roles on one of the planes, and she was the first female captain in American history.
I didn't feel like any of the individual stories in particular, and I think that's something they do really well, because it's part of the message that like it's about the community, it's not the individual. Like I always feel like none of the individual stories per se, maybe some people spoke to some people, maybe even the two of you guys, but like for me itself, like none of the individual stories per se were so essential. It was just sort of like the community message as a whole. I guess I'm curious, did you have like, Av, you're like the most New Yorker of the three of us, did you have like a history with this before? Was it on your radar?
I had heard of it. Like John, it was kind of one of those that was like on my list of like Broadway things to see at some point, most of which I never end up seeing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you see a lot of Broadway shows, Av?
Not a lot. I mean, definitely, I don't think a lot, like, for someone who's lived in New York for as long as I have. But, I mean, I've probably seen somewhere around 20 or so different Broadway shows over the course of my life, which, for I think an average person is a ton, but, not for someone who lives in Manhattan and is like, fairly into the arts and culture scene. I had never gotten around to seeing it. What I enjoy the most about it, and I kind of watch this kind of like on in the background as I did work one day. So I don't probably have like a ton to say about so many specifics, but I think this did a really great job at just like capturing a mood, and specifically kind of like that thing that was in the air in the days after 9/11 that I feel like nationally or even internationally, like society has been like trying to recapture since then. Just like mood of just like niceness and people looking out for each other. And it was just like so earnest and quaint in that regard. But like, as someone who lived through that and like really in like a very visceral way, I mean, like I wasn't directly affected by 9/11. I don't know anyone who was killed on that day, but I was in Manhattan on 9/11. you know, it was very intense. It was very, you know, scary to live through. But there was this just like, you know, honeymoon period afterwards where like it really felt like, you know, everyone had come together and everyone was going to look out for each other and like we could get through anything together. And of course, you know, the legacy of 9/11 has gotten darker and more complicated in many different ways because of, you know, foreign policy decisions and domestic policy decisions and all sorts of things that have really tarnished that, you know, positive thing to take away from 9/11. Not to say that, you know, 9/11 was this inherently positive thing in any regard, but like there was that like mood that like this play really does capture, that is like this this thing that I really was longing for watching this. And like it just seems like a society that's unrecognizable to what we're experiencing today,
I guess, in that sense. And I, John, this is what I was kind of also curious, because you know, you recommended it to me and you had a relationship with the musical from beforehand. In some sense, building on what Ob says, a musical is like the ideal way to then capture that story. Because I feel like musicals, yes, both New York and Broadway, and also musicals in their like, in their Broadway hands or like showy hands, because that's something I hated in the movie, the way like they dance and they do like stage hands. So that's it, like, you know, but something, yeah, about the showiness of a musical is also very community oriented, but it's also very, like weaving mythology in a sense, more so than like conventional movie does. Because I saw this and I cried out being like, oh, I wish I could have seen what they hoped to make, which is they were going to film more of a drama set in the town, etc. Maybe we sure. some of the music, but maybe this is like more optimal to capture that mood that Ob is describing.
I kind of think so. I mean, did we have this conversation offline, but talking about like movie musicals and sort of like whether they work for us or not, and yeah, whether they can like,
I was
kind of capture an authentic.
Yeah, I was pinging you guys a bit about that because,
right,
particularly in the beginning, of Come From Away, the first 20 minutes, I really wasn't connecting to it. It got me by the end of it. But the first 20 minutes, when they're doing all these like very forced sing-songing, I was just like, it's really necessary. Didn't work for me.
I understand, like they settle into a rhythm that I think works eventually, where you know you have some songs that don't feel like necessarily like they don't feel necessary, and then you're starting to get like dialogue spoken to you explaining like what's happening, and I feel like that kind of worked. And then you get into more like traditional Broadway sort of numbers later on when you're hooked into, you know, sort of like what's happening and some of the characters
and some of the characters like that, I think. Yeah.
Work better than ones earlier in the movie did.
But are any of these, I mean, were you humming any of the songs from Come From Away the next day?
Surprisingly, yes. And I'm not like, even like after I saw Hamilton like in the theater, and I, you know, not the movie theater, like the Broadway theater, and I loved it, but I wasn't like listening to the music afterwards all that much. Eventually that happened, like after I saw the version on Disney Plus, it reminded me of how good some of the songs were, and I've listened to them a little bit on my phone and such. But like almost immediately after Come From Away, I had a few of the tunes like queued up on my playlist, and you know, I haven't been listening to them as much over the last week or so, but for a good little bit, like they were coming up and I was enjoying listening to them and remembering, you know, details about the, I guess, movie that I appreciated.
Ob is going to hate me for this, but I liked Come From Away more than the other maybe notable musical of the year that I've seen. But I think I was clearly the highest of all three of us.
Well, Annette? Movie.
Yes, Annette. I was clearly the highest on Annette. I'm the only one who saw the whole thing.
Liked it more than Annette? Of course you liked it more than Annette.
No, no.
It was the worst movie ever made.
No. I'm the highest of the three of us on Annette. But like my point was that like Annette, I still find myself sing-songing some of their annoying songs. A month later, I can remember songs.
It's because it's like the song that never ends. It gets into your head. You just keep singing it. Like it doesn't mean it's a good song.
Yeah, you just hate sing. Like some people hate watch TV shows.
Yeah,
you hate
it just sing. Worms itself into your brain.
Yeah.
You can't
like,
get rid of it.
You know, and that has that song where they literally just say the words "We love each other so much," and they just repeat that over and over and over in like 20 different ways. And I found myself kind of in a silly, dumb way, kind of humming to myself, "We love each other so much." And nothing from Come From Away stuck with me. None of the same. My favorite scene in Come From Away is the sexy doctors. That was the highlight of the. Besides the emotional beat, which worked for me, I love the sexy doctor scene in Come From Away. That to me is a great 2021 movie moment. I don't know if there's. I mean, so is there a particular moment in Come From Away, John, which you're going to be like, oh wow, like that was it?
Is there a particular song?
The doctor, I mean, the pilot song.
The pilot, I thought was good, and I mentioned that maybe that was like one of the more prominent characters because the actress who played that role was, I think, the one who sort of received Tony consideration when this was, you know,
up for Tony Awards. Saying because she got some critical award, you're therefore saying you liked her scenes. John, you're
no, right. I liked her scenes because I thought she was a good singer and I thought that I liked the story, but I think she was considered the leading actress in what is otherwise definitely an ensemble piece. And maybe she was first billed or something like that. But yeah, no, you're right. It is an ensemble. I liked that part. I liked, you know, the sort of love story that unfolded. I thought, you know, there were some other things that like it didn't work for me quite as much. But I think on the whole, I agree that like what's most appealing about this is just sort of like the vibes that you get from it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard to like speak to that. You sort of have to just experience it and feel it. But I would recommend this to just about anybody, especially, I mean, it was, I thought, moving to watch it. It came out, you know, I don't remember if it was on September 11th or that it was that weekend. And I watched it right when it was available.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like fresh in my mind. And
the timing made it all the better. On this, so I think we all kind of liked Come From Away. Also just a great title. I think it's the title, you know, obviously was inherited. A movie that I know at least some of us strongly disliked, The Card
Counter. Not all of us.
Yeah. So I'll just get it out. I thought The Card Counter was a complete miss. One of the worst movies of the year. I'll just keep myself there. My only comment about The Card Counter might be that one of the movies I did want to recommend that I saw just an hour ago is called The Guilty, which is a remake of a European movie. The reason I'm saying it in context, and maybe Avi can comment then if you like The Guilty, is that The Card Counter is all about, I guess, guilt. And The Guilty, I guess, is about guilt. And I didn't see the original European version. I want to catch up with it. I quite liked The Guilty.
It's exactly the same.
Oh, okay. So I quite liked The Guilty. I think it's like the director and the actor, like the perfect roles. The director loves those movies. The actor loves those kind of roles. I'd recommend The Guilty. It's on Netflix, but I'm curious, particularly your take on The Card Counter, you know, and obviously if you want to tie it into The Guilty as well, you're welcome to.
Yeah, I mean, I was really, really excited for The Card Counter. Anything Paul Schrader puts out, I'm going to go see. Taxi Driver is like legitimately one of my 10 favorite movies ever made. And I've always been a huge Oscar Isaac fan. And my experience watching this was like, I kept thinking that like the little pieces that they were throwing out were interesting. Like you get a little bit of his backstory and then like, he's going to go do something with this guy. And like, it's kind of like very intriguing. And then it's kind of like this year of movies where before you know it, you look at the time and it's like, oh, there's only 20 minutes left in the movie and nothing has happened and nothing's going to happen. And I don't know why we spent all this time establishing like backstory that didn't matter and had him just like sitting through blackjack and poker scenes where nothing really happened. I just like found myself at the end feeling like this was just like a really boring, pointless waste of my time.
I felt like that, but throughout the movie. So I think
it definitely kept hooking me. Like I kept thinking like, oh, okay, like now it's about to go in an interesting direction. And then I was just like, oh, but no, it's just like these like loose ends that just like went nowhere.
I think one of the things, John, I'm really curious how you're going to defend what Av says, and maybe you can defend this. I feel everyone besides Oscar Isaac was terribly miscast.
I love the cast. I thought it was just so eclectic and like you sort of expected certain things from all of them. And they're really just sort of revolving around Oscar Isaac in a way that I just found interesting. I don't know that like there's great performances besides his, but I appreciated that it was an odd assortment of actors that were bringing different energies to these roles. And that ultimately like your focus was entirely on him the whole time still.
So I disagree. John, can you defend this? I mean, defend what the opposite, but to really defend this, the core of this movie to make it work for you has to be the relationship of Oscar with Tiffany Haddish's character and Oscar Isaacs with the teenager, Ty Sheridan. Those two relationships have to seem real for you to care about this movie. Those two relationships were completely fake. I felt there was zero authenticity between his relationship, his romantic relationship with her and his like father relationship with the kid. So
I think that for me, it was more like the details of their relationship weren't that important to me, or I think that important to the movie. I think it was more just like him and his routines. And that's really what the movie was about. And I feel like that's kind of why it works, because it is like, you know, we're setting up that, like, you know, he's done all these, he has this dark, dark past that he's trying to sort of escape. And to do that, he has to have a consistent and constant routine. And they talk about that a lot between the, you know, the different characters and him. Is like, isn't this boring? Like, what is this leading to? And he kind of says, like, this is what I need to do. And really, it's like, he's just doing this stuff because he can do it to get by until he can, like, sort of open himself up to moving on and almost forgiving himself. And like, what it is that allows him to do that, I didn't think was that necessary, but sort of what happens afterward is really like what I found appealing. And he, you had this moment where he's in the hotel room with Ty Sheridan, and he's sort of like, it's like he's sort of finally allowed himself to move on. And he does it in like a really twisted way that I was sort of on the edge of my seat waiting to see what he was going to do. But he does sort of feel comfortable enough to kind of move on and feel good about himself. And then, you know, the rug gets pulled out from underneath him. And I just found that like really, really interesting and satisfying, intense. And I thought it was like, you know, the movie we talked about up front is directed by Paul Schrader, sort of like the big name director of any movie this month, right? And
his last movie was first. Is because First Reformed was so good. I was shocked to see that Paul Schrader has made garbage movies every 2 years for the last 15, 20 years. So like
he makes his most recent movie was First Reformed, right?
Oh, for sure. First Reformed was excellent. It was like my number one, number two of that year. But like, I'm going to call out Oz and say, I don't believe him. And I don't believe you in that. Like, Paul Schrader was some guy who we loved when he made movies for the last 20 years. We were like, oh,
no, I don't think
he wrote a screenplay in the 80s and then he made First Reformed. But besides that, it's like garbage city.
It's Taxi Driver and First Reformed. So, you know, it's, you know, that's, for me, that's enough to see. If somebody's made two great movies, that's enough for me to want to see.
Also wrote Raging Bull, for the record.
No, for sure.
So, but I mean, he's definitely known more as a writer than a director.
Oh, for sure. For sure. But like, he's directed a movie every 2 years for the last 15, 20 years. And most of them are like straight to like, not even garbage Netflix, because it didn't exist. So I agree that First Reformed has lifted him into sort of a director that we all want to go out and see, but that's a very short leash. I mean, he's a guy who wrote amazing screenplays 40 years ago, and then he came out with a wow movie a few years ago. And now I think he's just gone back to what he did for the last 20 years, which is churn out. I don't know. But I mean, clearly, John, you agree with me because you like this.
No, not necessarily. I like this movie, but I also just like, you know, and I don't think he's a real person in real life who I want to like be standing up for necessarily. But as, in terms of his like career, like he's directed other things like Affliction, which I've never seen, but like Nick Nolte, I believe, won an Oscar for that. Like, it was a pretty like big film when it came out in the late 90s. I've never seen Mishima, Life in Four Chapters, but that's like a really, I think, beloved movie. American Gigolo was, you know, kind of launched Richard Gere's career. So like, he's done other things. I agree that like First Reformed felt like it kind of came out of nowhere. I, weirdly enough, like, I don't think I'm as high on First Reformed as you are, Sammy, and I think I like The Guard Counter a little bit more. I think that like the package comes together like in a way that like in First Reformed it felt like he was running from something and never really kind of got it never came back around like the way this movie does in kind of a moving way. I was moved by this, by what happened here, by in the last kind of act, without saying too much to people, but and I just think Oscar Isaac is so good. He's just totally sold it.
Yeah, wow. Strong. I mean, my strong disagree has been said enough, so I think
this is like our biggest argument to date, for sure, right?
Yeah. I mean, this was just even the production cost on this movie seemed like trash. Like, there's a scene
where I finished it like 15 minutes before.
So there's a scene like where he, first off, you know, I just feel like the casting, even to the most minor characters, is garbage. Like the guy who's like the American flag guy, I just feel is like a
Like, oh, that was so, it was so funny. He's such an idiot.
And yeah, like, but you just know, like, this is like lazy casting, lazy script. The script in this movie, I think, is bad. Oscar Isaac is turning bad lines into like passable lines. Like, so what I'm saying, even the production cost, like, there's a scene where they're going to play the big poker tournament to go into the World Series of Poker. And there's like, yeah, I don't know, 15 people sitting in chairs in this big empty room. I don't know. I've been to casinos for like nothing card game events that have a much more alive feel to them. I don't know. I mean, I'd be curious whether you're defending this at the end of the year. I hope you aren't, but I guess we'll see. But
I'm pretty sure I will be. But that's we can resume this at that time.
I'll take Free Guy and Ryan Reynolds over this every day of the week and twice on Saturday.
I will say, so real quick before we kick over to Ab, a better casino movie or gambling movie than The Card Counter is Mississippi Grind, which stars Ryan Reynolds in what I think is Ryan Reynolds' best performance, and also stars Ben Mendelsohn in what was, I think, one of my favorite performances of the last decade. So I'd recommend people check that out if they haven't seen it, Mississippi Grind. Card Counter, you can, I mean, you know, hit me with your best shot.
Give us Card Counter, Av, and then bridge us into the world of Av.
Oh, I don't really have anything more to say about Card Counter. I said my piece. I didn't really care for it. I had really high hopes, but it did not materialize in those expectations. The one other thing I will say that people should watch from this month, and it is not a movie, it is a TV show. And if you've been on Twitter, I'm sure you've heard about it, but everyone should watch Squid Game. Don't even look to see what it is. Just watch it. It's completely amazing. So very watch good. It. Thank me later.
Very good. Av, from Squid Game to the Sinensky life, listeners may have noticed that we opened this episode with Av. And the reason we did so is because Av wants to bring us into his life. So Av, share with us the movie bio that John, myself, and I think Will already has paved the way. Is that fair?
Yes, I guess I'm the last to go of our There Will Be Pod hosts. Past, present, and possibly future.
Yeah. So these are what? These are going to be 5, 6, 10. These are the movies that that give you a sense of
These are seven movies that I've picked that I think tell a story both of my personal life and my movie life. These are all movies that I really liked, and I think they represent the types of movies that I like in certain ways, and I think also tap into certain aspects of my personal life. And I decided that since movie podcasting and podcasting about movies has become such a big part of the way that I experience movies today, I would build in that in as well. And as most listeners know, I used to co-host a podcast that is still going called The Movie Ladder. So mm-hmm. I have elected to arrange these seven movies using the rules of The Movie Ladder, where each movie has to connect to the one after it in some way. Some of which will be better than others, but I did the best that I could. I chose my movies and then looked for the connections. I didn't choose movies just so that I could connect them.
That's kind of neat that you can connect them, though.
Yeah, well, we'll let the audience
choose. We'll decide if there are appropriate connections. Real quick before you start, I was a guest on The Movie Ladder.
Yes, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Oh, okay, go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
We'll get there. Okay, so we got seven movies. So we're going to start out with the movie that I think anyone who has listened to this podcast before or knows me or talked to me about movies knows that this is the movie that has that really defined my childhood, and that's The Wizard of Oz. It was a movie that was just like basically on loop in my house from as far as I can remember. I don't know why. I guess my parents were really into it, but they like played it all the time. Like we would like dress up in, you know, we had the costumes, we would dress up in them. I must have seen The Wizard of Oz 100 times when I was a kid.
Who were you dressing up as? Which character?
Honestly, all of them.
What a dodge.
No, I mean, we had like all of them. I think I was probably Dorothy the most just because, you know, she was the main character. And I think this is just like really the first movie that like did the type of world building that I've really grown to love in pop culture. Just, you know, whether it's Harry Potter or Game of Thrones or, you know, Marvel, all sorts of different things that like, you know, I've been drawn to. Just I love things that just like ask you to return to them over and over again. There was also a sequel called The Return to Oz, which like I would tell people existed and they didn't believe me because like no one else had ever heard of this. So like we just like had like this VHS in my house and I would just like watch it over and over. And like, it also just like had that sense of like a movie that only belonged to me because I would make reference to it. People were like, you're insane. There's no like second Wizard of Oz movie. And I know I sometimes still feel like that because it's this really like deep cut, like, cult film that's like really dark and really wacky.
I'm sort of surprised, you know, because I went through a phase somewhat similar, but on a literary note to you, where I got really into reading. There's prequels written. I'm not sure if they're all written by the author of The Wizard of Oz, but there's a lot of like published literature in the world of Oz. I'm surprised that all that IP, I don't know who owns it. I'm surprised all that IP hasn't been like whipped up into some sort of extended universe.
I completely agree. Yeah. You would think that somebody would be looking to make an Oz extended universe with all the different, out of all the different books and,
characters, and
movies, shows. Yeah.
The stories are there.
Yeah. I would guess that HBO now owns the rights in some capacity through Warner, but I don't know.
Yeah. So what was, so that basically set you up for your modern day MCU. I don't know if that set you up for your interest in Survivor. Your interest in Jewish comedians. I can see like the trails running from Wizard of Oz to all those interests, no?
I don't know about Jewish comedians, but yeah.
I mean, I want to know the Survivor connection.
Let's unpack that.
Yeah, there's definitely a Survivor theme, I think, of the characters of Oz heading down the road. I mean, isn't the whole idea, I mean, we don't have to go too much into Wizard of Oz because we've done Wizard of Oz before on this pod.
Yeah, I mean, it's
metaphor for like the gold standard and all sorts of
things. There's like Gilded Age stuff. I can't really speak intelligently about that sort of stuff. I've read it over the years, but I don't have it I'll regular thought, as they say.
But Survivor so too is a modern parable about the I have never seen Survivor, so I've never heard about it.
Let's move on. It's completely packed with just like the typical like Joseph Campbell hero's journey that is flooded in Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and ton of other stuff. So we'll go now to our second movie connected by the theme of movies about dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to go with Field of Dreams, which I said on numerous occasions during our sports movie bracket of 2019, was it 2019, 2020? Has got to be my favorite sports movie. It was a movie that a babysitter who used to babysit for me when my parents would go out once brought it over, and I was just like completely blown away by it. I loved it. And then like I would always tell my parents that like I only wanted that person to be my babysitter, and that tell like his parents to tell him to bring Field of Dreams so that we could keep watching it. It taps into like this notion that exists with baseball that I don't think exists with any other sport, where it's like the old school legends that just persist as the greatest players for always. Like Joe Pisanansky was just talking about this on a podcast I listened to last week. I think he was in a conversation with Bill James that like in the three other major sports, like everyone agrees that the best players of all time are playing right now, regardless of what you think about like the Jordan versus LeBron debate. I think even the Jordan team would say that, okay, Jordan aside, like everybody else is like the most gifted players are playing now. But for baseball, for some reason, like it's Mickey Mantle and Jackie Robinson and Babe Ruth and Ted Williams that still maintain this just like larger than life, presence in the culture. And there's just like something about the magic of baseball, the way it's passed down from father to son to grandson, generation after generation. And just like the magical realism in this movie that has always just like persisted with me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just doing my own movie ladder as you go. Is there a character particularly that you identified with or you most sort of looked up to in the Field of Dreams?
The Joe, Shoeless Joe in the movie is just like, this character that's just like, you're yearning for him for this like wrong to be righted. And, whether or not it's in real life, that's the case. In the movie, it's certainly presented as a situation where he got screwed, that, he didn't do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's just like this hope, like every time you see this movie that like things will be made right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. So I'm keeping track here as well of so far we have Dorothy and Shoeless Joe. You see yourself as like the tragic protagonist. So you have to follow Dorothy through a few, I think, of the sequels to see the.
All right. Well, if you're a tragic protagonist is what you like, then we're going to go for movies about fathers and sons. And this is a movie that
Godfather Part One.
Yeah, no, touches on a topic that, like, I've said on numerous occasions that, and this is something that I've talked about with my parents a lot, because it's even more relevant to them. But it's there's a feeling that I have, and that I've my mom has also told me she has, where you feel like the most important event of your life happened before you were born. And for my family, that is always squarely talking about the events in Europe in the late 1930s and the early 40s. And of course, many movies have been made about the Holocaust. And I am the grandchild of 4 Holocaust survivors, 2 who left Europe immediately before the war, 2 who spent time in concentration camps and lost their entire families, their entire villages, their entire way of life, and everybody that they knew. And of course, there are many, many movies that have been made about the subject, but the one that has always spoken to me the most, because of the just like the personal connections that I see in it, is a movie called Life is Beautiful, an Italian film directed by Roberto Benigni. It's in a way, it's almost like this like Holocaust slapstick comedy, which people who know me would know that that's part of why it appeals to me. And it's about this, father and son who get taken to the camps, and the father, in order to kind of like ease the burden and like have his son not really understand what's going on, turns it into like this elaborate game, almost like Squid Game, honestly, in real life. I think just because of the fact that like both of my grandparents were, you know, pretty young children when they went through this, and then obviously developed into, you know, parents and grandparents, there's that like the duality of the father-son relationship in this movie, where like I see obviously my grandparents and the child who's going through this thing that they obviously just like don't understand, that is much bigger than them, but then also the concept of this parent who kind of just like takes on the burden to protect the child from what they're going through, is something that I always felt during my life, that like my grandparents like were very, kept these things very close to their vest at times about talking about what they went through. I think as a way to just like not force their children and grandchildren to have to deal with it more than was necessary. The inciting incident when they are taken to the camps also happens on the son's birthday, which resonated with me because my grandmother's father was taken on the day of one of my grandmother's older brother's bar mitzvahs. They came to the house and took their father, and they never saw him again. And that has always just like really hit close to home. Possibly the most memorable part of this movie for me is the acceptance speech that Roberto Benigni does at the Oscars when he is named I think it's when he wins the best actor, not the best foreign film. And he just kind of like, he like gets up on his chair and he like dances his way down like from like chair top to chair top to the stage. And it's just that's always stuck with me as well, and it's just always been like this really powerful but like light movie on a very dark subject that, you know, really brings a lot of humanity to the forefront.
Can I ask, when you were thinking this, you're like, there would need to be a Holocaust movie in my selection to capture sort of who I am and my background. Was that kind of your approach, or was it more the father-son thread?
Yeah, for this one, I knew that I wanted to choose a Holocaust movie. And then, you know, I thought of a couple. The other one that I was thinking of going with was very different. I was going to go with possibly Inglourious Basterds for all sorts of different reasons. I thought this one was more appropriate.
It's so interesting when one thinks of like, what are the kind of contemporary kind of Holocaust movies? I would never have thought that someone's like go-to movie to capture like the Holocaust per se is Inglourious Basterds. But hey, go figure, you know?
Inglourious Basterds is more of a wish fulfillment Holocaust movie. It's like the Holocaust as it could have been,
yeah,
where, you know, you view yourself as the, you know, the person getting revenge and killing Nazis and, you know, preventing bad things from happening. This is kind of more as it was, even if it's with more of a light sensibility touch to it than most films on the subject. So for number 4, I will continue the theme of fathers and sons with here a more specifically Jewish theme continued. And that is the, I think it's a 2013 or 14 Israeli film called Footnote. Sammy, I don't know if you've seen that. John, I'm guessing you probably haven't.
Yeah, I think I'll just say
quickly, I saw Footnote.
Footnote is one of the best movies ever made about the academic experience. As weird as that sounds.
I can see that, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, this one for me was like, you know, I spent, you know, a huge percentage of my life, probably from the grades of like sixth grade through like the first 2 years of college, where a third of the academic study that I engaged in was focused on the study of Talmud. How much of that was a waste of my time versus how much of it was productive. I guess, you know, people can debate that. It's really laid the groundwork for a huge percentage of my, you know, academic career. And it's also just to me like one of the best movies about like parenting in terms of like the way that parents can become jealous of their children. You know, we're taught that parents like just like have nothing but just like unadulterated like love and just want the best for their kids. And like, there's no, you know, parents don't have like anything that's like themselves and like their kids' success. It's all about that. But like this movie kind of really flips that on its head. And like, in a lot of ways feels a lot truer to a lot of father-son relationships that are out there. It also just has a very like Coen's Brothers sensibility to it with like life as just like this cosmic joke. The movie starts out basically, it's like this father and son. The father is like this very, you know, renowned Talmud teacher, and his son is, you know, his, you know, an up-and-comer, and the Israel Prize is being awarded, which is one of the most renowned academic awards in Israel. And the intent was for the prize to be awarded to the son, and the committee that puts out the call accidentally calls the father and then has to renege it. And it of course brings to the surface all of this, you know, longstanding grievance and jealousy and, you know, just like bad will between this father son that plays out over the rest of the course of the movie. And it's just like has like this like absurdist humor to it, but is also just like very powerful and very poignant. And it's a movie that I was just like blown away by when I saw it. And I always recommend it to people, even if, you know, you don't have a, you know, Jewish or Israeli background. I think
that's the thing. It's one of the rare, because Israel has so many loaded themes, you know, Holocaust legacy, Arab-Israeli conflict, you know, I don't know, gay issues, like the movie we spoke about last time. So, because there's so many issues in Israeli society and history and everything else, you rarely get an Israeli movie which really, I think, it thrives in a completely non-local context. And this one feeds off, as you said, of like some of the, you know, the Talmud history context or whatever, but like it doesn't need that. It's a movie I hadn't thought of at all, but it definitely wouldn't be a personal pick for me, but it's interesting that it sort of is a personal pick for you, but it's also a movie that isn't fundamentally, you know, it's not like the Coen Brothers movie I picked per se, where that's like distinctly also Jewish Americana. This is a movie set in Israel, but it's not distinctly Israel whatsoever, right, even though play upon themes.
Yep, I agree. Okay, from one legal code to another.
The report.
Come back to this. No, not the report. Uh-huh. This is the movie that was recommended and successfully picked by John Gilpatrick on the most recent episode of The Movie Ladder. Oh. That is John Grisham's The Pelican Brief. And I swear this was a complete coincidence. I did not plan this. I jumped out of my chair when I was listening to the episode last week and couldn't believe that we were going to be talking about it basically on the same day that they're going to be talking about it.
Yeah, seriously, that's so funny.
So I was just like an absolute diehard fan of John Grisham when I was a young teenager, probably starting around 10, 11 years old. I read them all, one right after the other, became completely obsessed with them, probably played a big role in the reasons why I became interested in the law and went to law school. Not that there's generally a connection between legal thrillers and the actual practice of law, although I will say that to its credit, The Pelican Brief is one of the few that actually shows, you know, a lawyer doing the unglamorous work of being a lawyer. I mean, Julia Roberts, the main thing she does in this movie is just like sit in a legal library for most of the movie, just like, right, like reading treatises, reading books, trying to figure out, you know, behind the scenes, what's caused the murder of these two Supreme Court justices. And like, I give it credit for that. That's like, you know, that's a tough thing to translate into a movie, somebody just like sitting in a law library.
Yeah.
There's also just like all the politics of Supreme Court justices in this movie, which has become a huge, fascination of mine. I've always been like a huge fan of the Supreme Court and like been really interested in reading that sort of stuff. And of course, like when I went to law school, just like absolutely devoured, you know, different legal opinions, and have continued to retain an interest in the court and its decisions and its politics to this very day. So like that component to it made it one of my favorite of the John Grisham collection.
If not, this is very best. this is one I've never seen. So I'm going to watch this in honor of your and in honor of John's episode, and then I'll catch up on both of those.
And then you can listen to this week's episode of the Movie Ladder.
No, that's what I'm going to do. But Av, I'm a step behind, so catch me up. Are you father or son from your two previous movies? Which one do you identify more? And who you identify with, the assassin or with Julia Roberts in The Pelican Brief?
I would say in Life of Beautiful, the father. The father's amazing. Okay. Roberto Benigni is hilarious. The son is kind of, he's not really that present. In Footnote, the son, for sure. The father's a huge asshole.
Okay, nice.
Pelican Brief, I think I'm Julia Roberts. First of all, Darby Shaw, all-time great
book. It's a great name.
Yeah. Such a great name, yeah. I actually know another person named Darby. She's a 19-year-old girl who lives in my neighborhood who babysits for my kids sometimes. And like every time I'm like, how did you get the name Darby? Like this name only exists in The Pelican Brief and you. Like I've never met anyone else with that name. So it's a great name. I'll be Julia Roberts in The Pelican Brief.
Nice.
And I will not be the assassin, although Assassin is my next connection. A movie focused on an assassin of multiple people. Nice. And that is Wes Craven's Scream. One of my favorite movies ever made. I've probably seen this 15 or 20 times. I think it completely revitalized the slasher genre and is like the first movie that made me interested in those types of movies. Like there was a whole slew of like I Know What You Did Last Summer and all those movies that came after this. It also has what I think is one of the best opening scenes in movie history, and I'm like a big sucker for movies with great opening scenes. I actually looked for it. I know I once made like a list of like my favorite opening scenes of movies, but like I couldn't find it in my Gmail or my Google Docs. So I don't know where I made it, but like this is definitely up there. And like I have a sore spot for movies that just like open really strong and like really like let you know, here's what you're getting. And then, hopefully they live up to that for the rest. The way this movie just also like broke the fourth wall, introducing the rules of horror movies, made like the characters in the movie aware of the fact that they're in a horror movie, is this sort of like Charlie Kaufman stuff that I really love. Obviously this is not a Charlie Kaufman movie, but like this is to me was like one of the introductions to those types of movies that I really love, that I would like continue to enjoy over the next 20 years since this came out. So
it's also like a movie nerd's movie, as you're saying, in that way.
It has this like self-awareness that like I think movies didn't really do until like the mid to late 90s that became like a theme that would started being really explored. And as I said, I think most notably by Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. What is, who are you in Scream? And, you can go across genders, across motives. I don't remember any of the characters. So I think
I don't remember the name of the characters either. I'll be the guy
Courtney who tells
the rules of movies. No, not okay. Courtney Cox. I'll be the guy who tells, what's his name?
The guy who explains his name.
Yeah, no, but the guy who explains the rules of the movies. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, but that's right. That makes a lot of sense. How old were you when the first Scream came out? You saw it like that year?
I was 13. Yeah, I saw it in the theaters.
Oh, okay. Do you remember? Yeah, do you remember that experience?
Yeah, it was awesome. Like people were going crazy. I think Scream was like a really big hit. Like everyone was seeing it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean that's a we've spoken about this in the past. Like when. When the movie I think I picked, I can't even remember my movie bios now, but what is it? Man, I'm so bad at remembering things. Kid at home, his parents leave, robbers break in, he has to defend his house.
Home Alone?
Yeah. So, yeah. you and I would be a good partners in playing that home game where you have to like describe things and the person has to pick out what you mean. Except I would always have to describe and you would always have to pick the right noun or name because I would never be able to pick the name of the noun. But yeah, Home Alone was also, there were sort of movies I felt maybe just because we were kids at the time or in the 90s as we were teenagers, where I feel like there were movie events that obviously we're going through 2 years without movie events because of theaters closed. But I agree. Scream was like a movie event, like Home Alone and Scream were like movie events of the decade in a certain way. Yeah, at least in my memory.
Yeah, Home Alone is the movie that I say is the number one movie where if somebody of my age, one of my peers, told me that they had never seen, I would be the most surprised. Like I just like wouldn't accept that somebody who was born like in the late 70s to mid 80s had never seen Home Alone. And there's no other movie that's really close to me on that scale.
Yeah, Scream was more a certain age bracket, a certain...
Also, it's like, a slasher horror movie, which many people are just not going to see, no matter how good you tell them it is.
Yeah, that's true. I feel it kind of drifted into comedy in some sense, but I guess it's looking at it through goggles after what came after.
Yeah. Okay. So, and let's.
So does that bring up? That was your penultimate pick.
That was my penultimate pick. Okay. Scream, a movie featuring two people with the last name Arquette, Patricia Arquette.
Yeah.
Is going to be my next pick, and that of course is going to be the movie Boyhood, which I've spoken about over and over again as my favorite movie of the last decade, possibly in my top five movies of all time. It's a movie that just like shook me to my core the first time I saw it. Some of that has to do with the timing of it coming out, like right when my first child was born, and like kind of watching it in that, you know, time period on, you know, a movie about a child becoming an adult and like the way that time passes, the way that, you know, an adult parent, you know, has to watch their children leave the house, and feeling like this whole, like, you know, this thing called life that like we're kind of always waiting for it to begin and it's like before you know it, it's over. I always like compare it to that like feeling when you like you go on vacation and you're checking out and you see that there's like another family checking in and like you're so jealous of them that like they get to do what you just did. Even though you just did it, like you were like, you should like be, you know, you're full, you know, you ate, you had a great time.
It's funny like, because there's people who finish family vacations that are like so happy to be checking out, but I like your optimist spin on it.
Yeah. Even if it's like, okay, you're ready to go home. There's still just like this wistfulness of just like, it just goes by in a snap. And it's like, you're like, we're just on, you know, you just landed and got your bags and you're already going home. Mm-hmm. And there's just like that nature of like, you know, the line that Patricia Arquette says towards the end of the movie that just like, I always thought there would be more. And like, it's just like, you know, I'm raising two kids and like, I'm kind of still feel like my life is getting ready to start, but it's like, obviously like from their perspective, like, you know, I have the job that I've had for the last 10 years. And like, this is, you know, the dad that they had while they were growing up. And like, that's just is what it is. And like, you know, I sometimes watch movies with like people that are going to college. I'm like, oh, college, that'll be fun. I'm really excited to get to do that one day. And then like, you're like, all right, like, you know, all this stuff is already in the past. All this stuff is already, you know, things that you think are still to come have already happened. And I just think, it, you know, it's a movie that for me really captures the experience of being a child, the experience of being a parent, the way that childhood is something that just like happens to you to a large extent and you like really lacking in that agency that even if it sometimes feels like you have, and then you become an adult and you all of a sudden you have all that agency that you don't know what to do with. And just like the way that just like timing plays a role in everything. Just to like end off like this, the song from the very last scene of this movie was a song that I chose for a like we made like a movie montage for like my oldest daughter when she turned one. Mm-hmm. And we used that scene from that song from the movie, which I can't remember the name of it now, so I sound like an idiot. We would always watch that movie together and she would listen to the song and like we called it the Annie movie. Mm-hmm. And then one time I was she picked up my phone and she was like kind of like shuffling through my pictures or my music or something, and she saw the Boyhood soundtrack, which was on my phone, and she pointed to it and she said, Annie movie. And I said, yeah, that's how I think of it.
Yeah, nice, nice. One thing I'll say, which is, you know, I don't know if it speaks to the history of our podcast together, but it also speaks to the fact that, you know, you put your champions out front, which I appreciate. But I would say, this is just a recognition of that. All of your picks, I think I've heard you extol before, maybe with except for the Pelican Brief. The Pelican Brief, and what was the other one? And Footnote. I think those two. Yeah. I haven't really heard you speak, but like, and so it speaks to the fact, like, the movies that have shaped you are movies that you bring up a lot and that you reference a lot. And that's as it should be, because you know they're not, yeah, you know, you're not hiding them behind in a cupboard somewhere. But they're, you know, they're movies that, how would you say, you don't necessarily make a point of going back to see all of these. Some of these, like, they caught you when they caught you, and you know they've done their work. Well, like The Wizard of Oz, maybe you'll go back and see a bunch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The song, by the way, is "Hero" by Family of the Year. Yeah, I mean, you know, Boyhood I've seen twice. Scream I've seen 20 times. Pelican Brief I've probably saw like 5 times. Footnote I think I saw only the once in theater. Life is Beautiful I saw once, I think. Field of Dreams, Wizard of Oz again many times. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, these are in a lot of ways the movies that define me. There's obviously many other movies that do that as well. You know, there's you know, there's not a single Quentin Tarantino movie on this list, not a single Paul Thomas Anderson movie, no Martin Scorsese movies, no Steven Spielberg movies. So, you know, there's obviously many, many, many more amazing movies that are, you know, huge parts of, you know, what have made me into this like avid movie watcher and movie commenter. But yeah, these are the ones that I think just like really connected to me and like in a really personal way, in addition to being movies that I really loved.
Yeah, but also you're not, like we were talking at the top, you're not just swept away by the name of the director in terms of, you know, what you're drawn to. So respect there. If I could drop a classic corner on you before we have to depart, it connects to eighth grade, which was Will's movie biopic, one of his biopics. And that's when eighth grade came out. What, it came out, what is it, 2 years ago, 3 years ago? It was being called in a lot of, you know, descriptions, our generation's Welcome to the Dollhouse. And at the time, I kind of read that, but I didn't really know what Welcome to the Dollhouse was. And I caught up with Welcome to the Dollhouse last week, 1995, a movie that came out, directed by Todd Solondz, if I could, you know, get a pass on his last name. And I'm not quite sure. I liked it a lot. It's not an easy watch. I think that, I mean, eighth grade, I think, benefits from, you know, literally inheriting not just Welcome to the Dollhouse, but a lot of other, I think, similar movies, both from the 80s and the 90s, that sort of eighth grade built on. And then eighth grade had this unique, very distinct, first off, the casting, which Welcome to the Dollhouse does as well, but really, you know, that social media is a obviously deeply contemporary framework that eighth grade embraces. Though I always felt that the beauty of eighth grade, which is a movie I know you like more than me, wasn't simply you could strip away all the digital media, Facebook, social media stuff, and it was more just about the alienation that people feel from, you know, I think other kids at that time, and you know, that whole sort of drama takes us into. That said, Welcome to the Dollhouse has a lot more story. I think it's darker. It's kind of avowedly darker. But what it does ultimately to me that's most similar to eighth grade is that I particularly found the lead in eighth grade annoying and frustrating. And the lead in Welcome to the Dollhouse is not like a good girl. Like, she is abused by her family members. She's literally almost raped by another student, but it ends up being, you know, not as bad as you think. And yet she herself is an asshole to other people. I mean, she's repeatedly an asshole. And some of it you could blame, like, because she's treated, therefore she treats other people like that, but like, she's not a good person. I would recommend people catch up with Welcome to the Dolls. And if you like it, it was like Wiener Dog, which I didn't see. Wiener Dog is directed by the same director about 5-6 years ago. And Wiener Dog is like a sequel, so to speak. It has some of the same characters. He's one of those art house directors where he kind of weaves some of his characters into all of his successive movies in a way that there's no real connection, but the names and the actor will pop up again briefly. So have you seen Welcome to the Dollhouse?
No, I haven't.
Because you liked eighth grade a lot, so maybe this will...
I loved eighth grade. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll add it to my list.
I would add it to the list then, particularly if you're an eighth grade fan. I stumbled into it. So, you know, that's where it took me first. Actually, you know, I'm not even going to remember. Oh, yeah. Just One of the Boys is a movie that got me to Welcome to the Dollhouse. Just One of the Boys is like a super corny 80s teen movie. And I saw that. And then my younger brother said, if you saw Just One of the Boys, you have to go back and see Welcome to the Dollhouse instead. So that's how I got to it. I snuck in two classic corners there to cover for John. Av, any you want to leave us with?
Yeah,
you gave us a lot of classics, but
I'll throw one in. I'll throw a classic corner that is actually a movie that I saw this month for the first time, and that is Dirty Work, of course, an homage to the late great Norm Macdonald, who passed away in September. It's a movie I'd never seen before. I've always been I've always really loved Norm Macdonald and his stand-up comedy. I've never really done like the deep dive into like all of his, you know, stand-up specials or, you know, seen any of his movies or any of the things he's in other than like, you know, the occasional Weekend Update. Like, I guess I'm just like, I've seen a lot of random YouTube clips of Norm Macdonald over the years, and I've always liked them, but like I never did the work until recently when he passed away, which is a shame. So I got around to seeing Dirty Work, and it's just, you know, it's completely Norm. If you like him, you'll enjoy it. I don't think it necessarily quite works as a movie, but like as just like one like little, you know, vignette to another of just like Norm being Norm in, you know, ridiculous situations. I think it was quite enjoyable.
Do you run down when there's something in the news about some pop culture figure, whether they're an actor or director or otherwise, do you tend to like run down and try to catch something you might not have seen related to them, or You know, like certain people, like when someone dies, like they'll be like, oh, okay,
yeah,
X died, I'm going to check out like.
Yeah, like when Sean Connery died, I rewatched Entrapment because that, mm-hmm. that was always like my guilty pleasure, Sean Connery.
That was your excuse to rewatch Entrapment. Okay, good to know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I like to, you know, it's certainly like it gives you an opportunity to watch something. I feel like in this world where there's just like we're completely overwhelmed with like way too much to watch, it's as good a reason as any to pick something. Mm-hmm. It's kind of just like siphons it up. It's like, okay, I'll watch three movies that this guy was in because he just died. Like move those to the top of the list when it's just become, for me at least, it's like I have like so much anxiety from like curating what to watch and what to watch next and whether to watch movies or whether to watch TV shows or whether watch new stuff or old stuff. It's just it can be maddening at times. Mm-hmm. So you know, sometimes it could just be helpful as a way to like kind of let something rise to the top of the list.
Yeah Well, you know, I mean, look, you're someone I don't identify with foreign language productions per se, but you gave us a rare TV rec that was, you know, out of left field. I mean, not out of left field in its popularity right now, but certainly out of left field in terms of something that would get to the top of your queue. So
I watched it in English with dubbing though. So I don't know.
Oh yeah. I didn't know it's been dubbed. Okay.
Yeah. Netflix does a remarkably competent job with dubbing. Like it's, I mean, I'm sure we've all watched dub stuff over the years where it's just like unwatchable because of how cringy it is and how, you know, off like the mouths are with the voice, the voices sound weird. Mm-hmm. They do a pretty good job with it. It's obviously not perfect, but it's very passable. And for something like this, where I was like, just like on the edge of my seat and wanted to binge this in like the whole series in 3 hours or whatever it was perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, I've seen a few of the classic karate movies, like kung fu movies from the 80s or whatever from Hong Kong. And sometimes the dubbing just adds to the hilarity and the like the ridiculousness of it when it doesn't quite fit. I haven't seen this. I haven't seen it yet. I know my wife's been binging it. So I might catch up. I might just jump into, can I jump into the middle or will that ruin it for me?
I wouldn't jump into the middle. I would watch the first episode.
Okay. I will start from the top on your recommendation and will take your and John's renewed optimism in what we have in the witching hour next month because the witching quarter, because you know, things have been a bit scattershot. To be fair, I think, you know, maybe just leave this my last sense. There are a few good movies that I know I missed. Cop Shop, Language Lesson. Some of them are kind of bigger releases, some of them sort of smaller indies, and I just wasn't able to get them in front of my eyes this month. So I think there was a bit more this month than maybe we gave credit to. So maybe, you know, when we have a chance to catch up on some September movies a bit later in the year, September will look a little bit nicer, and you know, maybe 2021 will come around. But you know, there's a few movies from I think the last few months that I'm still giving credit to this movie having some further potential.
Yeah,
that's all I got. Speak to you next month.
I don't wanna be a big man. I just wanna fight with everyone else. Your masquerade. I don't wanna be a part of your parade. Everyone deserves a chance to walk with everyone else. While holding down a job to keep my girl around, and maybe buy me some new strings and her a night out on the weekend. And we can whisper things, secrets from our American dreams. Some protection, but I'm a kid like everyone else.